Well, welcome, Oksana Timofeeva. I don't know if you will exactly answer to these last questions that we are having, but I know that you will, that you are dealing with, extremist philosophical aspects of the substance oil and its use in petromodernity. Benjamin, kannst du weitermachen?
Oksana Timofeeva, you came here from St. Petersburg yesterday, and you are a political philosopher, and we are happy to have you here on the podium, and the stage is yours.
Thank you. As Georges Bataille writes in his very short essay, Materialism of 1929, materialism will be seen as a senile idealism to the extent that it's not immediately based on psychological or social facts, instead of an artificially isolated physical phenomenon. Thus, it is from Freud, among others, rather than from long-dead physicists, though whose ideas today have no meaning, that a representation of matter must be taken. The psychological aspect of matter, which Bataille tries to take into account in his conception of base materialism, should not be underestimated. Later in his book, The Accursed Share, Bataille expands his critique of political economy on the planetary scale and articulates the need to recognize in the economy, in the production and use of wealth, a particular aspect of terrestrial activity regarded as a cosmic phenomenon. This planetary activity is called general economy and is opposed to a restricted one that only registers the activity of human beings on Earth. Restricted economy is the movement of labor and accumulation, whereas the general planetary economy consists in expenditure and a non-productive consumption. As for the general economy, an ultimately destructive cosmic activity is totally indifferent to humans, but we are involved in it much in the same way as one is involved in a crime. The accursed share is a piece of matter that cannot be invested in any kind of production, but only wasted in a luxurious way, or literally put on fire. It has to be burned down or sacrificed. Why does sacrifice traditionally associated with fire? Because of fire's immanent elevating capacity. It brings things up, something one has to do in order to make an offering to gods. This is a religious aspect of our petro reality. As for the restricted economy, existence under a capitalist regime is bound to a general equivalent or a value form that can be attached to any piece of living and non-living matter. The world as we know it consists of commodities, and among commodities there is one for which all other commodities can be exchanged, money. Money is both abstract and real. It is real abstraction that, even if it does not really exist, produces effects in reality. In contrast to money, matter is not an abstraction. Matter is an ultimate commodity, as an ultimate commodity, is a concrete piece of substance to which money clings in order to prove that it is real. Such a piece of substance historically stands for the whole material world exchanged for money. It is a material side of the general equivalent, or the thing of economy, thus thing of economy. In the old times, the general equivalent was represented by gold. Now, such commodity is conventionally oil. Oil is the lifeblood throbbing through the arteries of war, says Hitler in Julian Simonov's famous novel, 17 Moments of Spring. No one can seriously dispute this today. Thus, in Reza Nigaristani's Cyclonopedia, it is oil that allows us to understand war as a machine, or rather two machines. On the one side, there is an Abrahamic monotheism, on the or jihad war, and on the other, a techno-capitalist war, or the war on terror. Nigaristani presents a set of ideas about the nature and origination of oil and its representations. He touches up on a popular comparison between oil and blood and relates it to the theory that he calls myth of fossil fuels, according to which hydrocarbons constitute the origin of petroleum. Both oil and blood contain porphyrin, an organic compound that serves as an evidence of a common lineage, the hydrocarbon. To put it very simply, the fossil fuels theory suggests that oil was produced from organic matter, from decomposition of various living or dead organisms, from bacteria to dinosaurs. Nigaristani notes very briefly that according to the classic theory of fossil fuels, petroleum was formed as a Tellurian entity under unimaginable pressure and heat in the absence of oxygen and between the strata in absolute isolation, which in his perspective comprises a typical Freudian Oedipal case. In other words, there is a libidinal dimension of petromodernity where universal death drive underlies all other drives and desires. When I was little, my family lived in Surgut, one of the centers of oil industry in the northwest of Siberia. As a school girl, I was very familiar with the dinosaurs myth. I was told that the oil was made of their bodies that were decomposing beneath the ground and the layers of permafrost. On my way to school, there was a shallow swamp. Each time when I was crossing it, I had a feeling that the ground is in fact never really solid, not only here but everywhere, also there where we think it is solid. It just covers this black liquid of the subterranean cemetery of enormous animals that inhabited the earth long before us. I guess I even believed that the scary dinosaurs could reemerge from a swamp created by an oil spill. Similarly to a Loch Ness monster protruding from the water of the lake. Dialectically, oil kept something from that organic life, the death of which was its origin. The oil of my childhood was neither living nor dead, but a living dead, an undead, or an uncanny and utterly inhuman afterlife of ancestral animals. The swamps of the north of Russia, the whole area of tundra, reminds of this oozy undeadness of substance. This area was never, however, a no man's land. Before the oil man, it was populated by indigenous people, Hanti and Mansi. There are still some of them there, living in special national reserves, not really reservations, and maintaining their culture, which nevertheless gradually disappears, being replaced by oil industry. They lived a pre-industrial life, having a reindeer, a deer, as their totemic animal. The reindeer is both a god and an ancestor of these people. Once a year, during the pagan fest, they cut a head of a reindeer and make the blood spilled. Some of the blood goes down to the people and some down to earth. Not far from my town, there was another one called Kagalim. It is also one of the centers of oil industry in Russia, operated by Lukoil company. From Hanti language, Kagalim literally means a bad, deadly place. It was named so because of the swamps that were taken and are still taking people's lives. When oil men arrived, Hanti had to leave and they left a cursed land as a space for a Soviet petromodernity, which was then entirely reduced to the exploitation of oil. A key word here is exploitation. The Marxian point here is that exploitation transforms a living labor into a dead capital. What do a slave, a worker, and oil have in common? That very fact that they are not only the repressed, but the oppressed, not only the unconscious layer of the society in which we exchange everything for money, but also the exploited, consumed, burned up in the production of surplus value. If we want to grasp oil, as Hegel would say, not only as substance but equally as subject, we must admit that oil that now stands behind money for the whole material universe is not a master, but a kind of ultimately unhuman black slave that literally occupies the lowest and the biggest strata of the pyramid of exploitation and creates the very core of our capitalist unconscious.
Okay, where do we start? Thank you very much. First, there's a whole lot of different keywords and aspects that you just named, and we want to talk about a couple of them. We have prepared one image, which is actually from one of the clips that we saw in our intro, from the very famous oil film Giant. With James Dean, we saw James Dean hailing the gusher, the coming of the oil. And here, this is from the original 1956 trailer. There you see kind of there are scenes from the film, and then you see a book through which they go. And one of the pages is this page where you can see the confrontation of the former historical cattle culture in Texas, with all the animals on the right side, and you see the new culture of the oil digging on the left side. And somehow it seems that in Russia there was the same situation, though maybe even more historically extreme, because these were not nomads anymore, those cattle holders in Texas, I guess. They were also already as kind of, like territorial agents of land, whereas here the confrontation was really between a nomad people that, as I think they are the same that are also in Finland and so on. It's like historically they would move along the north of the polar circle.
And it's the same group of languages and the same group of people. Right.
So I wanted to ask again, maybe you could tell a little more about this, what you said about the accursed place, and that there was actually really a concrete situation where the nomads, they would leave this name, Kogalym, and the Russian petromodernists took it without knowing that it actually meant that it was a cursed place, or?
It's actually, the most part of the cities there in the north is named they just picked up some Hunty names, and without really reflecting too much what does this really mean, it was the very phenomenon of naming is here plays a special role of what kind of a trigger, because it goes somehow, it gives you, it shows you, demonstrates you the unconscious dimension of the language itself. There is something behind. So the place, the name is given and it is picked up. There is no rational mechanism, I guess, behind this process. It is rather this unconscious or irrational scenario, and it's not that actually that nomadic people consciously that nomadic people just accursed this place and left, but it was already accursed.
Yes, for them.
It was already accursed, and then they left this place for some other. For newcomers.
And it was accursed because of the oil?
No, because it was just full of swamps. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just a too many swamps there, people. The funny thing is that not only them who are nomadic, because the oil men are nomadic as well. So the whole Soviet society was a nomadic society. How the work was distributed? When you finish the university, you get some job proposals and you can choose between the places. So usually you do move somewhere else. You leave your native land and you move somewhere else. So they were moving for their jobs, as the nomads on the north were moving around with their reindeers.
So the nomadism actually is what the Soviet society and the American society, modern societies share, have in common.
Yes. American, mm-hmm. Modern American society is totally like people travel. They are always travel from one place to another, and this is just an encounter of two types of nomadism. Let's say pre-industrial one, and pagan or totemic, and the monotheist kind of nomadism, whatever we mean by this monotheism or a certain eschatology behind their movements of those peoples. And of course the geologists are the first nomads. First the geologists come, then the oil men.
Yeah. So we see a map of this one of these oil fields there, and we see this water swamps and the technospherical organism on that surface, but do those nomads and these modern nomads, they don't have the same gods, and even with the oil, we don't know if the oil is the god or it's the slave, so it's perhaps beyond those dichotomies.
I think there is a huge tendency of either demonization of oil or mystification of oil as this Tellurian entity in our culture, contemporary culture, shared based on actually exploitation of this entity. I really belong to the part which thinks that it makes much more sense if we consider oil as in a materialist way as this analogy for proletarian substance. It's a kind of matter which, through being enslaved, potentially, let's say, educates itself. Without being even a human being, being a totally non-human agency, it is being developed and transformed and exploited and through this action it potentially frees itself from the power, from the mastery of a capital. But not now, of course, but maybe someday. Someday, who knows? Maybe we will not like it. Of course, we won't. But I consider it like this. In this encounter between two nomadism, talking about the swamps, what did we have? I mean, the Russians who came and who actually conquered this land. We had helicopters because you cannot. Why they called it that place? Because they could not cross the swamp. They didn't have this technological means, and the oil people came with these helicopters, and it became easier, much easier, to bring food, to bring water supplies there from one oil plant to another, and so on and so on. It's just a very big privilege.
So you grew up with helicopters?
Yes, I.
So you were flown by helicopter to school or what?
The school was closed, but I spent my childhood flying there and back in helicopters. I was lucky enough.
Wow.
My mother was working as a journalist, and she had this opportunity to use it from time to time to go to some godforsaken places in tundra where these well plants were situated.
Actually, no. When I started talking about it and about the giant thing, I started to make this analogy between, you know, territorial and nomad agents. But now then I realized that actually in Texas it's actually the opposite way around, you know, because those cattle holders, I guess, started to be, you know, there and tried to live there. And that is also the drama of the film, actually, whereas the oil business comes and kind of takes everything out and then moves away, leaving some kind of devastated situation. Mm. So yeah. It's, you know, very comparable also to how finance actually acts like an extremely nomadic way, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think the story of Giant is in part the story of a kind of denaturalization of the settler colonialism, which those cattle barons represented, because of course the people on the land originally were not them. You know, these were indigenous communities that occupied all of this area, and some of those indigenous communities are present in the Mexican immigrants, sort of who are the ancestors of some of those people, and those people are living at the very edges of these huge cattle baron landed estates, which are almost like the plantations of the Old South. And again, we have something like sort of a slave class, but we also have the completely obscured indigenous population, which doesn't figure at all in the world of the novel by Edna Ferber that Giant is based on, or the film. So we do have a kind of nomadism that is even, you know, invisible. And then we have the idea of settler colonialism as that which utterly replaces and is authentic and is of the place. And then we have the new nomadism of petromodernity, which becomes a kind of access to other kinds of intimacies across cultures. So the sentiment, I think the sentimental fable of Giant is that somehow the indigenous mestizo populations of Mexico were reunited with their colonizers in the automobile and in the automat and in the kind of conveniences of petromodernity. It's a fantasy.
But the Russian situation, or the Soviet Russian situation, in a way jumped this kind of intermediary phase, at least in these remote areas of Siberia, and jumped directly, so to say, in the post-colonial condition, into the post-colonial condition. I'd like to come back. Can we see the Prometheus image? I'd like to come back one more time to this complicated question of sacrifice and the Bataille theory, and you know, these two different kinds of economies, the extraction / exploitation economy and the sacrifice economy. We have two Prometheus images prepared. One is from Gabriel Orozco from 1928, first mural that this one of the three famous Mexican mural painters painted in the United States. And it shows more like a worker situation, I would say. So it's very, you know, contemporary for that time. The other one is from a Dutch painter from the 17th century, whose name I don't know at the moment, I have to admit. And it depicts the story that maybe is the most prominent of the Prometheus stories, that he steals fire to bring it to the humans. Whereas the other story that maybe is also interesting thing in our context is the story of the sacrifice and this kind of trick he plays to the gods, giving them, so to say, the worst parts and the good part to the humans. So I wanted to ask once again, maybe could explain that a little bit more. This difference, you know, you told us the story that the historical, the nomad people of Siberia would once a year kill their totem animal or sacrifice it and then give parts of it back to the earth, the blood, and somehow the new oil people do exactly the opposite. They extract the oil from the earth and don't give back anything, but I don't know, maybe that's too simple.
Oh, it's an interesting observation. I never thought about it before. I was having an idea that the earth is rather, to follow Hegel, for example, is a universal individual. So kind of the synthesis of living and non-living, or on that substance where everything, from where everything emerges and where everything goes back, right? There is a lot of mythology about it, about this. And this special kind of element, Earth, which only recently started to be a subject of philosophical, let's say, reflection, only starting from Schelling or 19th century. Before that, it was a little bit neglected or underestimated, and even like Aristotle, when he's trying to search where is the element for the such thing as a soul, a human soul, or living soul, anima, he says there were philosophers who thought that the soul is water or air or both or something else, but never, no one was thinking of the earth in this regard. Only after, let's say, German classical philosophers, earth became a serious part of philosophical reflection, but it was appropriated, immediately appropriated by the right wing or a conservative kind of protective thinking, the combination of soil and blood became a slogan for the right wing. I think that this is, and of course it goes to this archaic, it refers to the archaic complex of soil and blood, and but I think that this complex, this couple should be reappropriated from the right wing. Why? Because they consider them as abstract entities, as something abstract. What is land? What is earth? There is a Russian land or German land or whatever kind of someone's land. Whereas it can be no one's land, or it's everyone's land. It's just land, just ground. It's just a multiplicity of all living and dead organisms within it, and the blood is also substantial. It's not the German blood or Russian blood, but it's red. It consists of a certain microbiological things, right? Sorry for being a little bit approximate in this regard, and these things together give life to our bodies, and then these bodies they do bad or good things together or separately. I think that this should be reappropriated, and as well as oil, as this complex kind of blood of earth becomes a part of this struggle, and to bring it as a topic of discussion is very important right now in a materialist philosophy, in this human science debates and discussions. It's not a joke, and it's really something at stake, and that's what I think. Did I answer the question? No. I didn't.
I have immediately a new question, and this is if you think that it's possible to have a leftist combination of blood and soil.
Yes, totally. Totally. Okay. Let's say you said I have an extremist theory of oil. I wouldn't say it's extremist. I would say it's partisan. It's a partisan reading. Mm-hmm. This partisan is also a symbol of a certain power of the land. Mm-hmm. Against what? Against the fascism. Usually partisans, who were partisans? Partisans were people from the villages, right, from the little towns, who were struggling, who were having this conspiracy against the fascists, usually, and they were behind them there was always earth, the earth, the land itself, the animals, the forest. The fourth of the GU power was a partisan main comrade, so to say, the main support of this partisan struggle. So the forest was in struggle, the animals in the forest, the squirrels, whatever. That's how I see this this field of opportunities for this reappropriation of notions like this.
Do you think to make a keyword for a move to the materials table, which you know we already stand up, do you think that sacrifice would play any role in this kind of partisan activity? Because we were thinking about, what could we do actually, you know, like what kind of sacrifice or whatever that wouldn't be completely embarrassing.
Yes, but actually we don't do a sacrifice because when we talk about, we can talk about economy, which uses oil, but this oil has already left the spheres of economy, and it brings us here together in this room. So it is already something like a gift.
Yeah, it's a gift actually from the technosphere. Yeah, we came up with this.
So, yeah. So we don't have to.
You know this thing that you know that you have to. When you drink to the dead motorcyclist or something. You know, like one for the dead motorcyclist. So that would be maybe it, but. We can sniff it at least, you know. It smells really nice. Does it smell like the oil from your...
It smells fantastic, yes.
Yes, it's so rich, full of culture.
The very idea that this is a bottle makes us think that this is something probably drinkable, right?
We come to that later.
Yeah.
And not drinkable, but even if it's not drinkable, it's a negative form of drinking, right? This can be a poison or a remedy, both. This ambiguity of the liquid or
absolutely, substance. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's in our noir. This is also why we picked that word noir, you know, because it's completely about the ambiguity of this modern culture that it is putting into question. And you know, we had this in our intro clips. We had also this scene from a film from Azerbaijan from 1953 about the oil rocks in Neftashlari. And there we saw, you know, we saw the oil workers after it came, that we saw them putting in the oil in their faces. So that would also probably be an appropriate way of sacrificing some of it.
But now we come to our.
Yeah, we come to the next sound of oil.
Our music. Which is also,
unfortunately, already.
Which is also has also an anti-fascist story, as Alexander will tell us. It is.
Well, yes, but that's only small. It's only the conductor. Mainly, it's actually a capitalist story. What we heard already at the end of our intro clip was the beginning of Mendelssohn's violin concerto in E minor. Played by the New York Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Bruno Walter, so that's the anti-fascist story. And that was actually the first vinyl long-playing record that was brought on the market and successfully, so to say, that was the start of this explosion of music business. Already in the early 1930s, they had worked on that in the United States, but didn't come up with a solution that could be marketed. And then there was also the financial crisis and the war and so on. And then there was a whole laboratory at Columbia Records that actually had worked on that for a couple of years. And then in 1948, the time was ripe to bring it out. And then, so this is, so to say, the legendary first one that we're listening to it, or at least 2.5 minutes of it. Please, sound of oil.
Thank you.